going to add to your confusion or hopefully remove some of your confusion tonight. We'll see how we go. But more talking about the interface between science and the Bible tonight. I grew up in being taught the gap theory. I don't know if you're aware of the gap theory. It teaches that somewhere within between the first two or three verses of Genesis is a gap in there of a billion years. And I love science, as I said, and I sort of was taught at school that evolution was true, not as strongly as it's taught now. And at Sunday school, I was taught that the Bible was true. And I kind of put the two together, and I thought, well, if that's true and that's true, maybe the two fit together. And I grew up thinking maybe they fitted together. So tonight we're going to look at some of the reasons why I changed and no longer think that. So we're going to look at some of evolution's fatal flaws. What changed my life was Creation Magazine. How many people already subscribe to or read or know about? A few, but not each. This magazine, someone gave me a free copy when I was in my 30s. And I started reading it when I went home that evening, and I stayed awake until I finished it that night and went back and saw this man the next day. And I said, why didn't somebody tell me about this when I was at university? Why didn't someone tell me about this at high school, that there's evidence that shows that if you believe the Bible in a straightforward manner, we try to avoid that slippery word, you know, literally believing the Bible, because a lot of things in the Bible aren't literal, they're figurative. So I like the word straightforward. If you have a straightforward reading of the Bible, it suggests that God created everything in 6 days. And when I found out there's so much scientific evidence that backed it up, it made my whole Christian life so much more interesting. Sort of felt like my Christian faith was integrated with everything that I loved about science and that. I hate my voice as well. So it's really neat now that you don't have to leave your brain out there in the foyer when you come in once you understand a lot of this stuff. So Creation Magazine changed my life. It should have been when I was younger. It would have been nicer. If you went to a restaurant and ordered a meal off the appetizer list, or the entree list, you wouldn't be fair to complain to the restaurant manager and say, well, I'm not really full. Because an appetizer or an entree is not meant to fill you up. You should order off the main course for that. This talk tonight is not going to fill you up in a sense. Because this is such a big subject, all I can do tonight, and I've only got, was it 2 hours? You said it was 3. All I can do tonight is do a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and a little bit of the other thing. So the main course tonight is in the next room, and there's tables full of books and DVDs. So we didn't bring all those in the car to come and make money out of you. We brought them to so that I can get you interested enough that you might read or watch some of those DVDs to learn more yourself, so that you can go and answer your neighbours and your workmates' questions, because I won't be there to answer them. You guys are the ones that are there to do that. As well as the resources that are out there, the other resource you must know about is creation.com. There's more than 8,000 articles, I believe, on creation.com, accumulated over a few decades now. Updated, I think they have 6 or 7 new articles every week. Always new things coming out. So, highly recommend that. And if you've got a question, you can type it in up there. Type in carbon dating or dinosaurs or Neanderthals, which have been on the news today, I'm told. And you'll find what we say about it there. If you've got a smartphone in your pocket, we've got apps for that as well, for the connected generation, and hopefully a good on silent for our meeting. So, evolution, fatal flaws. The reason for this talk, it's kind of based around a brand new book that's come out, it's only been out a couple of weeks, called Evolution's Achilles Heels. You know what an Achilles heel is? It's a figure of language going back to Greek mythology, but it's talking about weak spots. And this has I thought I had my slides out of order. This is written by 9 PhD scientists on the weaknesses of evolutionary theory. So we're going to look at a little bit of this tonight, but this is a brand new book that's coming out. First, I need to explain, because words can be slippery, I need to talk about what I mean by evolution. And I've cleared this area across here so that I can use this to demonstrate a timeline of what your children and what we're taught in school as generally assumed secular science. So we call it the general theory of evolution of the universe and of life. So it starts with the Big Bang over here about 14 billion years ago. Now, you might not be able to see, but right in the middle of that screen, there's a little red dot. Once upon a time, they say all the matter, all the atoms in the whole universe were compressed into a dot far smaller than that one, in fact, it had zero dimensions. They call that a singularity. And for some reason, that exploded. Well, not really exploded, but space itself expanded faster than the speed of light, and hydrogen and some helium atoms formed in that first instant, and we moved into that space as it expanded. Then over hundreds of millions of years, some of those molecules of hydrogen start to stick together. And we got clouds of hydrogen, they got bigger and bigger and bigger, until eventually the clouds of hydrogen got so big that gravity could work on them, they imploded, and they formed burning hot stars. Over hundreds of millions of years now, moving through time, then some of those stars burned up all their hydrogen and they exploded into supernovas. And now, not just hydrogen, helium, but now as they explode, they're sending out the heavier elements, hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium, boron, carbon, nitrogen, all that sort of stuff that we're made out of, now goes flying into the universe. And this is why they say we're made of stardust. Planets formed, because clouds of dust started to stick together, but similar to the hydrogen atoms. Now clouds of dust started to stick together and get bigger, and rocks would hit and expand until gravity started to work on that big pile of dust. It imploded and it formed a red, burning hot planet. It took about a billion years to cool down that planet. And after a billion years, well, obviously there's no water on a red, hot planet like that, just as soon as any water comes. So after the planet cooled down, cometoids brought in frozen ices from the universe and brought in frozen methane and frozen water, which eventually filled our oceans. Then Darwin envisaged in a warm little pond with the sun shining on it, maybe a zap of lightning or something, some chemicals got joined together and started to replicate and multiply themselves. And then these single-celled creatures formed, and then some of them joined together and become multi-celled animals. And eventually, over hundreds of millions of years, we've got these little fishies that are in the sea. And they were swimming around. Some of them used their little footies to walk out onto the land. And grew into amphibians. And we got the amphibians. And they developed. And we got the reptiles. And we had the dinosaurs. They came and lived. And then they flew away as birds. They say, you know, don't say where are the dinosaurs. They say they're still up there. You just have to look up now as they turn into birds. We had the mammals evolve to fill the niche that the dinosaurs left empty. And then as the mammals evolved, we got bigger and bigger. We got the mice and the rats and the possums up to the primates, the ancient apes. Some ancient ape stretched up his back. Instead of using his hands just for climbing trees, he used them to make tools and things. And here we are, the pinnacle of evolution. Okay, so that is the secular theory of evolution that they will teach. And I forgot to do a few clicks. Here's my simple bacteria. There's the tree of life. Over hundreds of millions of years, of things lived and died there. And then we got modern man. So, let's just ask a couple of simple questions. Not many multi-choice, I can have A and B, that's pretty easy. The real question here is, can they both be true? The Bible says that Adam was created from the soil, that he was put to sleep and Eve was created from his rib. Or the story that I've just told you says that the first Homo sapiens came from some ancient kind of ape. Do you think they could both be true? Doesn't really seem like it to me. Seems more likely that one or the other is true. Let's look at time scales. I'll tell you later how I come to the conclusion that Adam was created about 6,000 years ago, but just assuming that for the moment. The evolutionary scientists tell us that Homo sapiens evolved about 200,000 years ago. Again, it doesn't seem like they can both be true. There's a different number of zeros. 6,000 is quite a bit different from 200,000. So, that brings us to a puzzle. And before we get into the detail of the science, we're going to think about this little puzzle. If the Bible is true, and if it is correct that Adam was created from soil about 6,000 years ago, how could scientists have the story that's a 14 billion year long story and has people evolving from some kind of ape? What is it about scientists? Ah, I know. Scientists are evil. They've got this evil plot to make us... No, I don't believe that. I know lots of scientists. I have many friends who are scientists. Ah, so just ignorant. No. They're not the ones who dropped out of school. They're the ones who were the duds of the school, many of them. And they worked hard and got their PhDs. So we've got to come up. We don't have all the answers, but we've got to come up with some explanation. And I've thought about this an awful lot, and this is my best explanation that I can give you. And I'll see if it helps. Again, it's simplified, but see if it helps you to understand why we have different worldviews. It's to do with the two kinds of science. Many scientists are not aware that there are two major kinds of science. They're not aware that they've only learned science, and this is actually philosophy of science. The first kind of science is called experimental science. Anyone like physics or chemistry or electronics like I do, those sort of sciences are experimental science. You do experiments over and over again. We could do one tonight, couldn't we? I haven't tested gravity yet. what do you think? Yeah, you've got the hot spot there. If I release my fingers, do you think this cup of water will go zooming out the exit? Do you think it'll go up and hit that light, or do you think it'll drop on the floor? You think it'll go down on the floor? Should we find out? We could do a science experiment tonight. If you've got your camera or something there, you could film it and actually measure the frames and see, measure gravity. We could do that tonight. Okay. That is experimental science. And you know the good thing about experimental science? I just went out in the kitchen before, there's a whole cupboard full of cups. You could all get your own cup and we could all test gravity tonight. Okay? That's experimental science. We made a prediction, predicted that if we let go of it before, that's our hypothesis. We could do the experiment. Somebody over here in Japan could do an experiment. They can write it up in a journal. You can read it over here in America and test it. No radio in Germany. You can test it again. Do it all around the world. So what other kind of science is there? Put up your hand if you think you know what the other kind of science is. No, one or two hands. Not so many. Oh, okay. Wow, listening ears. The other kind of science we could call historical science, or origin science is another name for it, or forensic science. This artist here, some dinosaur bones or fossils, is perhaps drawing a picture of the dinosaurs for National Geographic. did he bring the bones back to life and create these dinosaurs so he could draw these pictures? The dot, dot, dot shows you that he's having to use imagination because these dinosaurs are in the past and we cannot do experiments on them, on live dinosaurs. See that gravity experiment? We get lots of cups and we can do it. You know, we don't know whether the dinosaurs were warm-blooded or cold-blooded. And a scientific paper that just came out last month that said that quite possibly the mezzo, whatever the word is, are halfway in between warm-blooded and cold-blooded. We don't know, we're still trying to guess. But I found a better way to explain it, and excuse me for being a bit gruesome, but a lot of people have said this is helpful. Okay. I went to visit this lady this afternoon. I went to knock on her door, but it was sort of ajar. And so I pushed it open a bit wider and called out, and she didn't come, so I walked in, and she was dead on the floor. Oh my goodness, I went into a panic, there's my phone, 111, called the ambulance and the fire brigade, they turned up, and they tried to resuscitate her, she's definitely dead. The police arrived as well, and the detectives came in. Now, they're going to have to investigate what happened to this woman. What do you think might have happened? How do you think she may have died?
Fall.
She may have fallen over on the floor and hit her head and died as she hit her head on the floor.
Heart attack.
She could have had a heart attack.
Killed by a
helmet. Killed by... I'm not involved, though, sure. How might she have died? Use your imagination, what do you think? A rock falling on her head, something was the projector up in the ceiling or something, perhaps wasn't screwed on properly. Yeah, you're not very gruesome though, you're not.
Assaulted.
Assaulted. Perhaps she was hit over the head with a steel bar and someone stole her handbag. You girls there, how do you think she might have died? Imagination.
Killed by a robot.
Killed by a robot, perhaps he shot her. Perhaps he stabbed her. Perhaps her husband put arsenic in her wheat mix that morning. Okay, now I've had policemen in more than one of my meetings and they have agreed with what I've said. The detective has to consider all these possibilities. She could have died naturally, or what we call naturally, a heart attack or something like that, or there could have been foul play. He's going to investigate the possibilities. Is the detective going to use science?
No.
Yes, he is, because he's going to get, they're going to do an autopsy on the heart, and they're going to put the heart muscle under a microscope and see if the heart muscle's damaged. I assume that's how they do it. They're going to take blood from her, and they're going to look for chemicals that shouldn't have been in the blood. They use chemistry to do that. But I tell you what they're not going to do. They're not going to stand her up again, bring her back to life, and hit her on the head. No, it wasn't like that. Stand her up again, shoot. Oh, no, it wasn't like that. Why aren't they going to do that? Why aren't they going to do experiments on her and try killing her again and see how she dies?
Don't be arrested.
There must be some bribes up there. Why can't they do that?
It's not possible.
Can't bring her back to life.
You cannot bring her back to life. Number one, she's a unique woman. You can't even kill some other woman that won't tell you how she died. Number two. True? Yeah. And then none of these glasses of water. There's lots of them all the same. And we can do those experiments. But we can't experiment on this woman again. You can't bring her back to life. Her death is historical. Just think about the formation of this planet. Do they create new planets in the laboratory? Or maybe there's some other planets forming, over in Jupiter, there's some other planets forming, we can watch other planets forming. That would be the next best thing. No. So this is historical science. We use science to get clues how she probably died. Can the detective ever be certain how she died? Can science tell him for certain how she died? No. Maybe your husband invented a new kind of poison that they don't do a test for yet. That's happened also. Okay. He thought that was gruesome, didn't you? It's worse. It so happens that the detective that was brought in to investigate this case knows this woman, knows her family. She's got a lovely daughter, but unfortunately her daughter married a baddie. He's a druggie. And he often comes to his mother-in-law looking for money. And the detective says, aha, I'm sure the son-in-law had something to do with this. He goes to the son-in-law, finds him, says, where were you last night? Well, I was with my friends, drinking in the pub. Where's your friends? Let me hear. No, I'm not going to believe you guys. I don't believe you anyway. You're probably, I'm sure that's not true. And the detective says, I'm not even going to get an autopsy done. I don't need to. I know the son-in-law had something to do with it. Okay? You like him. Do you think this is going to happen? Yeah, am I talking about a good detective or a bad detective? Sorry? Bad. Why is he a bad detective? He's jumping to assumptions. What he should have done was gone with the evidence first and then decided where the evidence pointed. That's what he should have done. What he's done, in fact, we liken it to a horse that's blinkered. He's put on blinkers and made up his mind, and he doesn't even look over here at some of the evidence, doesn't check for poison, doesn't check for a heart attack, doesn't check for those things, because he's got a idea in his mind, he's made up his mind too soon. Does it happen? Do wrong people ever go to prison because a detective made up his mind too soon? Yes, it does. Could a scientist do something similar? Could a scientist make up his mind and say, I'm certain there is no God? I don't even need to look over there for any evidence in there. I'm certain that evolution is true. I don't need to look for any evidence that would suggest the human body is designed. You think that could happen? Does it happen? Oh, let's ask some scientists and see. Here's Professor Todd. I forget what he studies now. Probably got it written down here, but it doesn't matter. He wrote to Nature magazine, a Nature journal, which is one of the two top scientific journals. He said, even if all the data point to an intelligent designer, such an hypothesis is excluded from science because it's not naturalistic. He said, God is a supernatural force. And he said, anything supernatural is excluded from science. So even if you look like you were designed by a supernatural designer, that is excluded by science by definition, in his view. Does that sound like the good detective or the bad detective? Sounds a little bit... Okay, let's look at another one. Sir Francis Crick co-won the Nobel Prize for co-discovery of the shape of the DNA molecule. Just a few years before I was born, in fact. Biologists, again, thinking about the human body, biologists must constantly keep in mind that what they see was not designed, but rather evolved. You look designed, but you're not designed. You just evolved. I've got to keep reminding myself, you just evolved. You look designed, but no, you just evolved. Honestly, that's how it works. This man here, You can read it all, but I'll just take the few words that I bolded. He says, we take the side of science in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs. I'm an engineer by training. This chair has been engineered. First thing I noticed is that it has four legs rather than two. If it was sort of made by accident, it could quite likely have two legs, couldn't it? But it doesn't. Why does it have four legs? Because it's stable. It could have had legs made out of balsa wood. And Dean down here makes lots of models out of balsa wood. We could have made this chair legs out of balsa wood. Would you have sat down confidently on a chair with the legs made of balsa wood? No, you wouldn't. It's made out of steel. Or steel. I've seen those big signs outside New World, you know, big steel things like this. It could have had the legs made out of very, very big, strong steel. Wouldn't it have been strong? I would have been really confident sitting on it then. But pity the poor person that tries to stack them. So you take something as simple as a chair, it has been designed with a lot of thinking has gone into the making of this thing called a chair. There is not one thing in your body that's anywhere near as simple as a chair. So for an engineer, it's patently absurd, to use his words almost, to think that things would evolve that need design, that all these bits have to work together. It's no use if the legs were way bigger and couldn't be attached to the seat. They've got to fit together and work together. Every engineer knows that nobody put all these parts in a box and just shook them and it came out as a chair. So that's what he means. We take the side of science, in spite of the patent absurdity of some of its constructs, like saying that evolution is a process that's based on accidental mutations and natural selection, and then down near the bottom, because we have a prior commitment, a commitment to materialism. Materialism in this context doesn't mean getting rich, it means that everything is made out of matter, that everything's made out of atoms. I believe we have a spirit. I believe God is a spirit. Spirit is not made out of atoms, so he is only prepared to believe in things that are made out of matter, and therefore he has a prior commitment not to believe in God, even though it's patently absurd. And to finish the quote, it carries on onto this page, and you might have time to read that, but I'll just read this last bit. Moreover, that materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. Okay. We do not want to admit that evolution is not true, because that could allow people to think about the supernatural, and God's got his foot in the door, and what if people believed in God? So, not an open-minded man, Professor Richard Lewontin, an evolutionary geneticist in this case. This man here is more of a journalist or a science writer, and he had sort of come to a bit of understanding. He said the Genesis account of creation, which we'll talk about a bit later, may even be correct, but there's no way science can prove it or disprove it. Again, because we can't create Earth, so we can't prove evolution, they can't prove evolution, they can't prove the Big Bang, we can't prove that God made them 6 days. We can't prove it. We can look for clues to see if that is the most likely explanation. And he said, so that first part's true, and the creationists know it. Yes, we know it. We can't prove it, and they can't prove it. So what we should do, if we have open minds, if we haven't made up their minds too soon, if we have open minds to all the evidence, this lovely looking row 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. What if we had a murder, and we're pretty sure that the murderer is one of these five, but we don't know which one. It seems like none of them have a good alibi. What would the detective have to do? Look for more clues. Look for more evidence. Okay, you have to keep gaining evidence. Look at the size of their feet and the size of the footprints or whatever. Get more and more evidence. Oh, rule them out. His feet are too big. Can't have been him. That sort of thing. You get more evidence. And so with this issue, creation of the world, did we evolve? Were we created? As we get more and more evidence, it should point more and more to the truth. Most people are astounded, I'm probably jumping ahead of it, most people are astounded to find out that there is no theory of evolution at the moment. In fact, there hasn't been for a long time. The Darwinian evolution, or neo-Darwinism, scientists are aware that it does not work. There was a meeting in Altenburg, a city in Austria, just a few years back, and if you go to Google, type in Altenburg 16, 16 top evolutionary scientists had a meeting. The priests were excluded because they didn't want it widely publicised, And they had a meeting and they said to each other, we know that neo-Darwinism, our scientific theories, cannot account for life, they do not work, but we can't tell the general public that until we find another theory. And they've just published, in the last few weeks, they put up a website called thethirdwayofevolution.com. They don't believe in Darwinism, they don't believe in creation, and they figure there must be some third way, we've just got to find it. And that, of course, is a statement of faith. So evolution is a statement of faith, biological evolution at the present time. It's not even a theory. If this sort of thing interests you, science, the Bible, Genesis, that sort of thing, I'm going to hand in a couple of folders now. I'll pass them to the front and you can have a look and pass them back. If you're interested in signing up for an email newsletter, and as long as you can write your email address clearly so we can type it in, it comes out about every 2 months and we highlight things, and this one about the Neanderthals that just came out today, I'm sure will be mentioned in the next one. If you get it for a while and don't like it, you can just unsubscribe. So that's a free email newsletter that you're welcome to subscribe to. So back to this evolution, Achilles heels the book. 9 PhD scientists, that's their 9 names over the year, that work for Creation Ministries, wrote these 8 chapters on natural selection, we'll talk about in a minute, genetics, the origin of the first cell, the fossil record, the geological record, all the layers of rocks, radiometric and carbon dating, cosmology, and ethics and morality are the 8 chapters of that book. So I'm going to look in my Evolution's Fatal Flaws talk, I'm going to look at the first one of these concerning natural selection. According to secular evolutionists, evolution works by mutations. So when we get cosmic rays from the sun, they cause defects in our, or copying errors, if you like, in our DNA. And then natural selection is the one that selects, like the survival of the fittest. The fastest running deer sort of won't be eaten by the lion, so the deer will eventually all run faster. But the reason this is a flaw in the evolutionary theory is that natural selection doesn't add information, it removes it. And I'll give you a simple demonstration why. This comes up often, you'll see a headline in the newspaper, they say, evolution has been seen in practice working. We have seen evolution work. A disease in the hospital became resistant to antibiotics. The bacteria became resistant to antibiotics, for example. Evolution seen right before our eyes. That sounds very impressive. But that's not the sort of evolution that could make people out of bacteria. And we're going to show you this by doing a little science experiment in our minds. I'm going to try to breed a new variety of dog. There's all kinds of varieties, and I don't really like any of them. I'm going to make my own variety. We call them the hunt dogs or something. Anyway. I'm going to get a mongrel dog off the street to start up with. Because mongrel dogs are a great place to start a breeding thing because they've got their genes from up and down the street, you know, plenty of genetic variety in these mongrel dogs. In my simplified view, it has a gene for L for long hair and an S short for short hair. And this mongrel dog has medium length fur. And I want to breed a new variety of dog, a long, shaggy haired dog. There's a bunch of colour white fire. You girls like dogs? Yeah, right. Long haired dogs. So I'm going to get 2 of these mongrel dogs that have medium length hair, and I'm going to get them to have a little puppies. And when they have puppies, lo and behold, some of them are short haired because they've got the S from mum and the S from dad. So they're short haired puppies. I think they're ugly. These ones in the middle, half of my puppies, some got the L from mum and the S from dad or vice versa, and they just look like their parents as far as the hair goes. The ones I'm interested in got the L from mum and L from dad, and they're the long-haired puppies. So I give away all the ones I don't like, and I just keep my long-haired ones, and I crossbreed or inbreed my long-haired puppies. Lo and behold, the next batch of puppies all have long hair. And as long as I can keep my neighbour's dog out of my backyard at certain times, then I will have a new variety of long-haired puppies bred artificially. This is not natural selection, this is breeding. They will breed just in 2 generations. Now here's the million-dollar question. What new genetic information did I give them to create a new variety of long-haired dogs? No new leaders, is there? There's no P's or Q's or anything new. So what did I do to the genetic information to make a long-haired variety? I got rid of what I didn't want. I got rid of the S. I wasn't interested in that short-haired gene popping up in my dogs, so I bred it out. And every farmer who has sheep will know that as soon as if you're selling white wool, as soon as you have a sheep with a black ear or a black spot on it, then it's sorry, it's off to the breeding witch. You've got to keep that genetic information out to keep the flock pure. And same with my dogs. So I bred out information. Now, it's my long story over here. We had some bacteria formed about here somewhere in the warm little pond, and they eventually evolved into people. Whoops. Do bacteria have arms, legs, and eyes, and noses, and ears, and that? So bacteria doesn't have to have information for making arms. So to get from a bacteria to a person, we have to add information, how to make arms, how to make eyes, and all the other things we have. All that information had to be added. So evolution can only work if we know our way of adding new genetic information to creatures. In this experiment, I bred a new variety of dog by removing information, and it turns out that the antibiotic resistant bacteria in the hospital also, in every case that we're aware of, lose genetic information rather than gaining it. So what's this got to do with natural selection? We could achieve the same effect with the dogs by natural selection. Now, instead of breeding them, I just take my two mongrels, put them on the plane here in Christchurch, send them to Antarctica. If they survive on the ice the first few weeks, and eventually they have some puppies, the short-haired ones will probably freeze to death. And maybe the medium-haired kind of, and the ones that are likely to survive in Antarctica will be the long-haired puppies, the ones with smaller ears, because dogs lose a lot of heat through the ears, so their ears will evolve to be smaller. If you use the word evolve, their legs will get shorter, but it's also a source of loss of heat, and their hair will get longer. So I go back to Antarctica for 50 years, round up the wild dogs, and here they all are. They've all got long heads, short ears, short legs, etc. By natural selection. Again, the information would be removed. The information for short hair, they would have died. The information for big, floppy-eared dogs, they would have died losing too much heat. So natural selection does exactly the same as my breeding experiment. Takes longer, but has the same effect, loses genetic information. For evolution to be true, as I said, the arrow must be going uphill. The arrow of genetic information must be increasing. But what we see in the world around is that it's decreasing, and that fits more with the curse of Genesis 3. It makes more sense that things are going downhill. When we look at humans, we find indeed that mutations do occur. Our DNA does get destroyed by cosmic rays, and we are building up, can't see it quite so well, that says 500. There's more than a list of more than 500 genetic diseases, not really the right word, genetic defects in our human DNA that have built up over the years. So if your son wants to be an Air Force pilot and he's got colour blindness, I'm sorry. It's in your family who won't make the grade, and quite likely his children won't be able to be Air Force pilots or whatever as well. So here's a list of things. Now, I was stunned. I went back to university so I would have this chance to study evolution, and did some geology as well, and asked the professors, because I knew that for a bacteria to get to a person, they had to have an increase of information. And I figured they'd have a list of probably about 100 genetic mutations that increase the information, or if not 100, at least 10. But do you know when you search for the list of known genetic mutations that add useful new genetic information to the human DNA, or any DNA for that matter, here's the list. And if you study, anyone studied evolutionary biology, the only thing they'll talk about is sickle cell anemia, which actually was on the previous page down there. Sickle cell anemia. If you have that recessively from only one of your parents, you have it recessively, it won't kill you, but it will make you immune to malaria. And so that's the mutation that they will quote that is a genetic improvement, as long as you only have it recessively, and hopefully your kids won't desire it. So anyway, enough of that. That will be too getting off. So here's a seven-legged lamb. Wouldn't the butcher love this? Chop, 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 chop. How much is a legged lamb? You've got seven of them in yourself. But is the farmer going to be so happy? Now, I get to the butcher shop, probably won't live that long. This is a defect. So genetic defects, we have genetic defects, and they are not improvements, And the other way we lose genetic information is through extinction. Now, I was bright enough, I never really did very good in biology at school, but I was bright enough to know that the moas lived in New Zealand, but they were the world's largest flightless bird. I didn't even know about the harst eagle, was the world's largest flying bird. Was also in New Zealand and is now extinct. Was big enough, in fact, to prey on the moas. Must have been an incredible bird, but until now, we're not able to recover the DNA from those species that have got extinct, and so we're losing that. And so that's another way that we lose genetic information. Just think about it. Why are they trying to save the kiwis and the tuatara's and the whales and the dolphins and all these other things, jaguars and... Can't we just let them go extinct and new things will evolve? If evolution were true, wouldn't they? Let the tuatara's go extinct, if something new will evolve. Well, no, we do right to try to preserve those things, because when they go extinct, nothing will evolve. No new kind of creature will evolve to fill that space. So again, back to Creation Magazine. This is a great family magazine. It's a really nice colour magazine. Comes out 4 times a year. It has lots of interesting articles. It has a children's section in the middle for the younger kids. One of the neat things it has, and it's good to remind me to say this to you, it usually has an interview with a scientist who believes in creation. Don't let me give you the wrong impression. Don't let me have you thinking that scientists are against the Bible. There are many, many scientists that agree with the biblical account. Often, though, they are forced to keep their mouth a little bit zipped at work. And if you don't know that story, there's a DVD out there called Expelled, that tells you how many scientists will lose their jobs if they start talking about God and the Bible criticizing evolution. But if you're interested in Creation Magazine and grandparents, if you're looking for presents for the kids or something, or what have we got, Father's Day coming up soon, do we? Yeah, here's a present. You can subscribe for 1 year for $35 or 3 years for $98. And if you've got smartphones, tablets, laptops, etc., this digital version can go on 5 different devices. So if you subscribe, your wife can have it on her tablet, your kids can have it on their laptop or phone or whatever as well. And if you sign up for that and rip off the little voucher that's on the end, you can take it out to Andrew at the back, and he'll give you a free back issue if you sign up for 1 year, and a free back issue, and I think a $16 DVD. If you sign up for 3 years. So I'll pass those also to go towards the back if you've had a look. And I do highly recommend it as a great family magazine. So the second thing we're going to look at that's mentioned in this book is dating methods. And this is a common one. A lot of people haven't thought of how we work out how old something is. Anyone want to guess how old I am? Huh? Be brave, call out. Call out. Okay.
35.
There's a man, so complimentary. What are you doing? If we can analyse what's happening in your mind, there's nothing on me that's sort of a ticker timer that sort of says my age. So what you're doing in your mind, you're doing it subconsciously probably, you're thinking about your father, your grandfather, and thinking, he looks a bit older than Dad and a bit younger than Granddad or whatever, and that's how you work out your age. You ask your 5-year-old and they'll say 90 or 60. You know, they don't have any idea because they don't really know adults' ages. But that's how we do it. We compare it with other things we know the age of and work out whether it's older or the person is older or younger. Another example, if I want to set my watch to make sure I don't go for 3 hours, I could set it by that clock, but I'd really want to know that clock was accurate first, wouldn't I? We need some reference point to anything to do with time and dating, we need reference points. And that's why I say dating methods are fickle. Let's say they have a rock. Since there's a few children in the room, let's pass this around. I'll give you this for the kids. Do you girls know about Jesus' disciples? Do you know the names of any of his disciples? Yeah, what's the name? Can you call that one? Peter. Well, actually, Peter had another name before that. His original name was?
Simon.
And Jesus told him, he said, from now on you will be called Peter, which means rock. Here I've got a piece of firewood, and I'll pass this around and it can go down that way and up the other way. Here I've got a piece of wood that has been petrified. That's the same root word. This is petrified wood. This piece of wood has been turned to rock. And you'll feel the difference. One is warm and light, one is cold and heavy. It's been petrified cancer rock. So I'm going to talk about a dating method that could have been that could be used to date those two pieces of wood to find how old they are. And so I'm going to talk about carbon dating. Because when you get a fossil or a piece of petrified wood or something like that, it doesn't come on an age and say this one's 75 million years old. We have to try to work it out. So one of the ways we can do it is using carbon dating. Anything that used to be alive, like this pew that you're sitting on, used to be alive. It's made out of a tree. Okay, so anything that used to be alive can be carbon dated. Lava and stuff like that cannot. So how does it work? Most carbon is what we call carbon 12. But what happens up high in the atmosphere is some nitrogen gets hit by cosmic rays and it gets messed up and turns to carbon 14. And carbon 14 is radioactive. So most carbon is not radioactive, but a little bit is. And if the radioactive carbon joins up with some oxygens up there, it becomes radioactive carbon dioxide, which we don't breathe in, but the plants breathe in, so to speak. And so the trees and the grass in this picture, some of the carbon that they're made up is radioactive. Anybody here eat plants? Yes, we have salad for dinner. The cows here are eating the grass, or we might eat the cows, or we might eat some of the vegetables ourselves, and we become radioactive. Do you know you're radioactive? You are radioactive. Now, half of that radioactive carbon disappears every 5,000 or so years. When you die, you usually stop eating. It's a scientific fact. Okay, when you die, you usually stop eating, so you don't add any more radioactive carbon after you're deceased. But the carbon that was already in your body from all the vegetables you've eaten over the years, being a good boy or girl, then all the radioactive carbon will slowly disappear as if it's leaking out of a bucket. And every 5,000 or so years, it goes down by half, and they can test it in a machine and measure it. And after 10 half-lives, there should be no radioactive carbon. So anything that's basically more than 50,000 years, just as a rounded figure, should have no measurable radioactive carbon left in it. Okay? Oh, that's interesting. Dinosaurs went extinct 65 million years ago. So what if we were to test a dinosaur bone? Did a dinosaur used to be alive? Yeah, this bone, we can carbon that, it used to be alive. What if we tested a dinosaur bone to see if it had any radioactive carbon in it? And if it was 65 million years ago, they should not be able to detect any carbon in it. But if it's more recent than 50 to 60,000 years old, it should have detectable carbon in it. There's a problem. There's a Christian radio station. The interview's on YouTube. I'm not sure how you find it, but it's an audio transcript, audio script on YouTube, audio recording. A Christian radio station ran an American university. The professor had just announced that he had discovered some dinosaur fossils. And the Christian radio station said, please would you have those dinosaur bones carbon dated? The professor said, I would not be so foolish. He said, if we know they're 65 million years old, there's no need to have them carbon dated. That would be senseless waste of money. Does it sound a little bit like something I said earlier? The radio station said, sir, we will pay you the $10,000 that it costs. It won't cost your department anything. We will pay you to have that dinosaur bone carbon dated. And he said, I cannot do that. And they said, why? And I can't remember his exact words. It will stir up such a fuss. Well, basically, he'd lose his job. If he sent it to the lab and they found radioactive carbon, he would lose his job, because that's how it works in academia. So, let me give another example. It's hard for creationists, by the way, to get dinosaur bones to test. But what we did do is get some of, what do they call them, woman's best friend, you know, those expensive things that were made in the centre of the earth 2 billion years ago. Isn't that romantic? You can wear them on your finger anyway, they tested, they ground these diamonds down to dust and burned them up in this machine that measures the carbon and discovered that diamonds have radioactive carbon remaining in them. So diamonds must be less than 50 to 60,000 years old. They don't take billions of years. I believe that all this billions of years stuff, remember the story of the chair? These chairs are designed, they don't happen by accident. The billions of years stuff is what you sprinkle on impossible things to make people think they could possibly be true. And I believe all these billions of years are just imaginary. So the process of a bacteria turning into a person, and that something like an explosion can produce a nice ordered solar system, that we can have a calendar and we know when the full moon is going to be in 20 years, we know on what day of what month. You know, we've got a nice ordered solar system, it's like pottery. That's not the sort of thing produced by anything resembling an explosion. So I believe all these billions of years of fairy dust, and that's an example that shows you. So that's the sort of thing that's in that book. This book, why we have so many materials out there, for people that are interested in the Bible. This one is not a particularly Bible book. It does mention the Bible sort of on the last page or two. But it's basically a science book looking at the weaknesses in the secular general theory of evolution from the Big Bang right through to Darwinian evolution. So good to give to a skeptic as soon as you say God, some people just can't cope and turn off. So that's available. But I want to just take a few more minutes and talk about the Bible, because I love to talk about the Bible. And just tell you briefly what I believe the Bible is saying. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. The earth was formless and empty, darkness covered. Oh, deep waters. In the beginning, the earth was empty and void and was covered with deep waters. Remember when I was over here somewhere, when that cloud of dust imploded, we had a red hot planet, took a billion years to cool down. Is that a red hot planet? No, it's not a red hot planet. A red hot planet cannot have deep waters on it. It cannot be red hot and have deep waters on it. Okay, so, you know, I talked about when I grew up, I thought it was kind of, not really thinking about a lot, but I thought that maybe evolution and the Bible could somehow fit together. I mean, God could have started the Big Bang. He knew how it was going to finish. Maybe he had a nice armchair and he was sitting there watching the Big Bang. Oh, here comes the first, oh, the stars exploded. Yeah, all the big bacteria forming soon, won't be long. You know, he could have used the Big Bang, but he says that the planet that he made right at the beginning was covered with deep waters. He said, let there be light, and there was light. He spoke of it. Well, hold on. Some clever people said, how could you have light when the sun hasn't been made yet? Well, believe it or not, in this room, the sun is not shining on us at the moment we have light. So yes, you don't need the sun to make light. Lots of other ways you can make light, but electricity and all sorts of stuff. Anyway, the 4 days, I won't go through more. Day three, pretty great. Day one, he made the heavens and the earth. Day two, he separated the waters above from the waters below. Day three, he causes the ocean basins to sink and the dry land to appear. Puts all those nice carrots and cucumbers and Brussels sprouts and, you know, all those things. Day four, he makes the sun, moon and stars. Oh, in this story, the sun and the stars had to form first, and they had to burn out after hundreds of millions of years and explode before there was any dust to make a planet. But here we have a planet on day one, even though the sun and stars aren't made until day four. So again, the order doesn't fit trying to combine the two. Day five, he makes a sea, fills the sea with swimming creatures and the atmosphere flying creatures. Day six, he makes the land animals, which the T-Rex and the Apatosaurus were land animals, so I'm going to assume they were made on day six. And later in the day, he makes man and woman in his image. And to make a long story short, we've never thought about this before, but these concrete blocks that this building is made out of are grey. You never noticed before, but they have some thin layer of plasticky stuff on it that makes them yellow. Do you know why? Because we love beauty. When it says we're made in the image of God, could it be that we love, oh, some flowers, isn't that interesting? Could it be that we love beauty because the God who loves beauty made us in his image? Could it be that we love music because the God who loves to be worshipped, the music and the song, made us in his image? Could it be that I like building robots and somebody else likes a sewing machine and Andrew at the back there puts blobs of oil on bits of canvas and makes beautiful things? Could it be that we like creating things because the one who created us made in his image and we like creating things? Could that be what it means to be made in God's image? I think so. I don't let anyone, by the way, call me a human animal. It's fashionable now about. It talks about the human animal and how the human animal are overrunning this planet and we need to reduce the numbers. A scientist got a standing ovation a few years ago now at a conference. He said we need to reduce the population on the human animal back to 3 billion people. I can't thought you that first name. honestly, and you know, we laugh, but this is going to become more and more serious, I can promise you. We're heading in that direction. Anyway, the Bible. We believe, the standard Christian view, is that most of this book was written by men under inspiration of the Holy Spirit. Men like Moses and Isaiah and Jeremiah and Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. But not all of it. Do you know that? But not all of it was written by men under inspiration of the Holy Spirit. Who's shaking in his seat? Okay. The little bit that wasn't, part of it is up there. The Bible tells us that the Ten Commandments God wrote on a stone tablet with his own finger. So in God's handwriting, translated for us into English, the fourth commandment says, remember to observe the Sabbath day, work for 6 billion years, and work for 6 days, rest for one. And this is why. For in 6 days the Lord made what? In 6 days the Lord made the heavens, the earth, the sea. Heavens, I interpret that to be everything that's out there, the moon and beyond. The earth, yeah, we're standing on that, or I am. The sea, yeah, we're swimming there, and everything in them. Everything in what? Everything in the heavens, everything in the earth, and everything in the sea. So here, in God's own handwriting in Exodus, he confirms that he made everything in Genesis in 6 days, just like the straightforward reading said there anyway. But just in case you weren't sure. I said Adam lived about 6,000 years ago. Does anybody know the verse that says that? Well, I'll give him away. You can't get that from one verse, but with a little bit of calculation. You see, when Seth was born, his dad was 130. When Enosh was born, his dad was 105, and so on and so forth. And if you've ever been told a picture's worth 1,000 words, well, this picture's worth 10,000. I did this one. I typed those figures from those verses, Genesis 5 and Genesis 11, typed them into Microsoft Excel and said, produce a chart. And here is a chart. If you've never seen this before, it'll blow your mind. Is Adam, that green bar represents his life. So he was created at year zero, and he lived to be 930. When he was 130, he had Seth. So this is Seth's bar. So it doesn't show all the people, just some of them, of course. I coloured Noah blue, because a lot of water in his day. just to make him stand out, I added the red line to show where the flood was. And I can see on this chart that Abraham here at the bottom lived around 2,000 years after Adam was created. We know that pretty much within the year almost, when Abraham lived. But the other thing that's very interesting while this chart is up here is the orange dotted lines that I added. If I look at this orange dotted line, it's his Noah here, it's his Lamech, Noah's dad, that green bar there. When Lamech was a boy, his father, his grandfather, and his great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfathers were all still alive. Can you see that? Mm-hmm. Oh, what about Abraham? There's even more greats over here. When Abraham was a young man, his father, his grandfather, and his great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfathers were all still alive. You've heard it said, oh, somebody wrote the Bible and they copied it and they copied it and they lost it and they found it and they copied it. How can you believe that old book's so unreliable? Well, no. Imagine Lamech saying to Adam, what was it like? Tell me, Grandpa, you know, what was it like in that garden before God threw you out? Tell me, I want to hear from you. Just like we say, Grandpa, what was it like before I had TV? Anyway, and Abraham the same. We're not saying that they did, but these people were alive. Anyway, a lot of that sort of information is in the Creation Answers book. This is a little book that answers the 60 most common questions about creation. The single most common question that people ask about the Genesis account that are not sure if it's true or not, the single most commonly asked question is, who did Cain marry? Because we have Seth up on that chart, but Cain and Seth were brothers. Adam, Abel was gone, so that Cain and Seth married. Who did they marry? Does presuming not their mother. A lot of people are very confused. So this creation answers, well, answers those sorts of questions. And I recommend actually that every Christian family should have one of those. Well, not just have one, should read one of these as well. It's $18 there. So I'm not going to tell you who came married if you don't know, you can find that out. Okay, Adam up here, through to Abraham. As I said, I've done an archaeological dig in Israel. Got their passport photos, you know, it's really helpful. And Adam to Abraham was on the last chart, was about 2,000 years. Abraham to King David, it turns out, not so accurate this time, we've got a bit more variation here, leeway, but still fairly accurately, was around 1,000 years to King David, another 1,000 years to Christ. We have two lines here, because of the genealogy in Matthew and one in Luke. So we've got 4,000 years, 2,000 plus 1,000 plus one more 1,000, 4,000 years up there. According to my calendar that I've got here, it's 2014, so 4,000 and a couple more 1,000, that Adam must have lived about 6,000 years ago. What's interesting about this slide, as soon as Adam is created from the dirt, there's nowhere here you can slip in 1,000,000 years. Oh, maybe between Noah and Shem, no, you can't slip in 1,000,000 years. You could argue about a few decades or something if you want to argue, but once Adam is created, those genealogies are contiguous. I mentioned the Old Testament and the New, and you cannot add in any millions of years there. So, if Adam was created on day 6, and he lived about 6,000 years ago, the heavens and the earth were made on day 1, so if Adam lived about 6,000 years ago, this planet must be, according to the Bible, about 6,000 years and 6 days old. Is that simple? That's how simple it is. Now, the age of the Earth, I don't really care about the age of the Earth, it's just a piece of rock that we walk around on. But there is a theological reason why that we don't accept those sort of ages. I haven't got a slide for it, but let me just quickly tell you. If God created using this process of evolution, bacteria lived and died, and the fish lived and died, and the amphibians lived and died, so on and so forth, until people evolved. When Adam and Eve were in the garden, my Bible tells me that sin did not come into the world until they disobeyed God. And therefore, God could not have used evolution, which is the process of living and dying. He could not have used evolution to create as his method of creating Adam and Eve, because that would involve things dying before Adam and Eve had ever disobeyed God. See where I'm going there? So as a young person thinking that God probably used evolution, I was not aware that I was also believing that God had used the process of death and sickness and survival of the fittest. I was believing that he'd used those kind of processes to create a perfect world, and that doesn't make any sense. So I believe now that death came into the world as it says in Genesis chapter 3 as a result of death sin. I think I'm going to finish right there. I won't get into Noah's flood. I probably rambled a bit much. But hopefully that's been helpful, and I'm going to pass back to Andre now, and then hopefully we'll, if we've still got some time and you've got some patience, we can have a few questions before we go to a cuppa.
We do want to allow maybe 20 to 30 minutes for questions. It's important that you have an opportunity to address some things to God. What I'm also going to do is pass around these blue bags here. It would be really good if you could just show appreciation for what Robert has shared with us, but also this is a part of supporting his work of the ministry. It's really direct to you, isn't it, Robert, not creation ministries or... It goes to creation ministries. So it's good that we have that clear before we pass the bag around. So thank you for your patience thus far. Feel free to have a bit of a stretch. And then I'll just pick some questions and direct them to Robert. And then once we're finished, we'll probably end just with a quick song. And then there will be coffee and tea and refreshments served out back there. So you're welcome to stage and have a look at the books.
As Christians, how do you is on when you're looking at scientific evidence. Okay.
Now, very perceptive question. A very perceptive question that pointed out that just like I said that scientists could be blinkered, we could also be accused of being blinkered. If we believe the Bible, then we could be blinkered and not looking at other evidence that shows that we're wrong. And yes, we can. That's why I like to tell my audiences that if you've got young people that want to study science, they need more Christians to get into science. One of the disappointing things about science is this first scientist, Sir Isaac Newton, was probably the greatest scientist that ever lived. And he wrote far more about God and theology than he did about science. Science was started by Christians. And you know why? It was started by Christians because they were blinkered. They said, we believe that God made us, and therefore we are sure that the world will be a world of order. And they went and looked for the order in the world and discovered what we now call the natural laws. They discovered them because they believed in God. So their worldview affected their actions. Just like I, as an engineer, and I look at a chair and I think it's got to have happened, got to be created by somebody, clearly it didn't just happen by accident. So yes, we have to keep an open mind. Who else has a question? Yeah. And we have to be careful we're not blinkered. But remember the detective analogy. The more evidence we find, the more confidence that we have that it's pointing in the right direction. So if we get more and more evidence, it's pointing in the God direction. And if we get less or more and more confusion about evolution, and it's, you know, like I said, there isn't a current theory of evolution. Honestly, there is not a current theory of evolution that is known to work. Then, yeah, so you get confidence that we're on the right track, I believe. That's harder with Andre.
What about the distances to the stars and the light years, millions of light years? How does that fit with the Bible timeline?
Okay, another excellent question, which I'll tell you in a minute, but it's answered in the answers book. Let me explain the question in a little bit more detail. According to evolutionists, this whole process from the Big Bang to now happened over about 14 billion years. 14 billion years is quite a bit more than 6,000 years. So if the stars are more than 6,000 light years away, the light shouldn't have got here from those stars, but there are stars that are something like a billion light years away. So we shouldn't even be able to see them yet, but we can. So one possibility is they're not really that far away, but that doesn't seem to be the answer. So it seems to be something odd that we can see stars that are supposedly 2 billion light years away, more than 6,000 light years away. But actually the problem is way, way bigger than that, and this will help you to see something miraculous here. It said that God made the stars on day 4, made Adam 2 days later on day 6. Anybody know, apart from the sun, does anybody know the closest star up in the sky, how far away it is?
4.5.
Yeah, a little bit more than 4 light years away. So, light takes 4 years, more than 4 years for light to get from the closest star. Let's not worry about the farthest away ones yet. Can you imagine Adam on the evening of day 6, he's now got Eve, he's got his arm around Eve now, watching the sunset, the sun goes down, it gets dark, the sky is black, no stars, nothing yet, next year, still nothing. 4 years later, one little star pops into existence, because the light from the closest star gets to us. I think the next closest one might be something like 10 light years away. So another 6 years pass, and we now have 2 stars in the sky. So actually the problem of distant starlight applies not just to the ones that are very far away, it applies even to the closest stars. Because I don't get the impression from reading the Bible that Adam had to wait for years and years and the stars just slowly popped in one by one. So let's use Andre since you're silly enough to sit up front. Come and stand here, Andre. Something important to understand about miracles.
Okay, this is Adam. He's just been made out of the dirt just a few minutes ago. He's okay, he's 10 minutes old. Apart from the fact he's got clothes on, but we'll forgive him for that. Okay.
That's a
hot song. Okay. What do you notice about this man? Anyone who's had children and remember what they were like when you first saw them? What do you notice about this man? He's 10 minutes old. Anyone remember
him? He has the appearance of age.
He's not crawling, is he? He's actually standing up, but he's only 10 minutes old. I mean, it took my kids, you know, how many months before they could stand up by that without being wobbling. Okay. What were you going to do? Yeah, where do you live? Okay, so did you notice he can talk? He didn't say dad, or mum. He could talk, but he's only 10 minutes old. Okay, thank you, sit down. You see, if you had looked at Adam, and you saw him there, you would have been confused about how old he was. But if you had perhaps been able to take a sample of his DNA and go and put it in the electron microscopes or whatever they use for measuring it, you might have been surprised to find his DNA didn't seem like the DNA of an adult that's had mutations over the however many years he's been alive, but it seemed more like the DNA of a baby that was still pure. So you might have been confused about how old he was. He can talk, he can stand up, he seems like a man, seems like he's mature, and yet other things in his body might give an indication, his bones and that, you know, might look like that brand new. So anything made by miraculous science will give confusing results. Some things will appear to be old, some things will appear to be young. Another example is, let's go in our time machine. Jesus has just told the servants to scoop some of this liquid out of these bowls that were just filled up with water and take them to the master of ceremonies. The master of ceremonies was about to taste this and say, this is the best wine at the wedding, won't you leave it to us? But we're going to jump in there, grab a little bit out of that cup, bring it back in our time machine, take it to the university and say, what sort of grape was this wine made from? And how long has it been aged to make it the best wine at the wedding? What are they going to find? They're going to be confused. It might seem like it's actually been there a long time, but that was only water a few minutes ago. You see what I mean? When God does anything by miracle, it's going to confuse, and even the creation of the stars, and even the closest stars, how their light got here on that first day when Adam and Eve stood up and watched the sunset or whatever, it's all miraculous. Some scientists do try to explain it, and that brings me to another point that's really important to know, so I'll add this as well. Our position concerning the Bible is this. Anything the Bible says, we accept it as being true and reliable. Because this is proven in many ways, like the coloured pictures in the back. This is proven in many ways to be a reliable book. Okay, so the Bible says that it was a worldwide flood, covered the tops of the mountains, went over the tops of the mountains of the whole world. We take that very, very clear. But when we read between the lines and try to make a theory for how in fact God did it, that we can see the distant stars, we're reading between the lines, and then we stand to be corrected. We could be wrong. You get what I mean? If the Bible says it, we believe it. If we add it, then we stand to be wrong. So we have books out there about how God possibly used a reverse black hole, possibly used a white hole as his method of creating. And that could explain why that, to do with Einstein's theory of relativity, why that we can see light from distant stars. The book can explain it better than me, so I won't try to do that. So there are a lot of scientific theories, and creationists don't always agree. Some think plate tectonics was maybe what pushed up Mount Everest as two plates went flying into each other and pushed Mount Everest up. Others think, well, no, maybe not. And so we will write those theories in our journals and criticise each other, but we take for granted that what the Bible does say clearly can be interpreted and understood clearly and reliably. Is that sort of helpful? Pretty long-winded, I know, sorry. Added a few little bonuses there. Sorry, yes.
If we say it's the world 6,000 years old, the universe, how does carbon get in here? 57,000 years old.
Okay, another good question. If the world is only 6,000 years old, then why did we say that the diamonds could be up to 60,000 years old? At relates back to setting my watch by the clock to know it's right. Unfortunately, we don't have any rocks, bones, or anything that are 4,000 or 5,000 or 6,000 that we know how old they are that we can set our clocks by. Let's take carbon dating. If you didn't believe in the flood, like secular evolutionists who do use carbon dating, if you didn't believe in the flood, your carbon dating would be wrong. Because during the flood, all the vegetation that was there from before the time of Noah got buried under the ground. And so the carbon, lots of carbon got buried. We have coal in Antarctica that shows that Antarctica was once forest, but all that forest got buried. So carbon dating can only work back as far as the flood. So when we go that age about diamonds, we weren't saying that they were 60,000 years old. We're saying that is the absolute maximum date they could possibly be, according to what we know about radioactive carbon. So we believe they are less than 58,000 years old. So in fact, if it comes to the details, we believe they are less than 6,000 years old. You still get what I mean? That's an absolute maximum. We're not saying that it shows they're that old, because that hasn't had a correction for the flood where all that carbon was buried. Yes. So evolutionists who say they'll take a piece of rock and they'll say this is a million years old, or if they find a dinosaur in it, they'll say this is 100 million years old. They don't have any other rock that's 100 million years old they can use to calibrate the machine. So all those figures, that's what I said, all dating methods are fickle. What evolutionists do, they get a rock and they have it sent to the lab and they get a figure for how old it might be, let's say 100 million years old, and they say, oh, but it's got this fossil in it, we know it must be older or we know it must be younger, we'll ignore that date, it must have been contaminated. So this whole dating thing, no, you laugh, but there's a DVD out there about a geology one, and it'll have the dating game, we call it the dating game, because honestly, in science, in medical tests, they publish things in journals. When some doctors do a test, and they test if this medicine works. And then over here in Germany, I said yes, you're about to do the same test. They've actually found that 90% of scientific tests cannot be replicated. Because the people over here were so excited that they didn't actually do anything carefully, and it cannot be replicated. And so many, many tests, including dating, can't be replicated. They're not actually scientific. So it's only just come out really in the last year or two that many things that have been accepted as scientific knowledge are now dated because people get so excited that they didn't look at things like contamination. So dating is really just a game where they only pick the dates that match what they want to say and they ignore the others, and they don't publish the ones they ignored. So they never publish negative experiments. If you did an experiment over here that failed, you don't publish that. But actually, the fact that it failed is a piece of knowledge. That this experiment fails would be a useful thing to publish, but that's not going to get you, any high honours that you did an experiment that failed. So they don't publish that. And when they choose to ignore dates that didn't match, they don't publish that they ignored the dates that didn't match. They just publish that they did the dates that matched. This man over here was first in
our
creation.com, my favourite page on creation.com, you type in age of the earth in the search box, and we have a page called 101 evidences that the earth is not billions of years old. And all the things on that, like the age of the diamonds, other things, are absolute maximums, and we still maintain that historically the Bible makes it clear that Adam was 6,000 years ago, and that must be approximately the age of the earth as well. So those dating methods, if we say something is less than 50,000 years old, yes, well, that fits 6,000. 6,000 is less than 50, so if something proves it's less than 50,000, that proves, we're happy with that. We can't necessarily date things exactly at 6,000 because we don't have a reference either to set it by.
Yeah. I'm wondering, what does the dating record, what does the carbon dating record show for dinosaur fossils?
Yeah, I wonder the same thing. What I've done the carbon dating show for dinosaur fossils. Unfortunately, they won't give us access to fossils. I'm not aware that creationists have had them carbon dated.
Are you saying that there's been no dating, no carbon dating on the dinosaur fossils?
Not that I'm aware of, yeah. I'm not aware. I was thinking even if I said it, I should check out, but I'm not being aware of it. I know that creationists have asked to have things dated by the example I cited, and they will refuse to have it done. Yes, a lot of ignoring gets done, yes.
When, in the early days, people were living to 900 years or whatever, is the fact that we're not living to that now because of the degeneration of rather than the... Is that why we're not living so long?
Okay, I mentioned the arrows that if evolution were true, we should be having genetic improvements, we should see them. We do lots of surgeries on people, cut lots of people over for operations. We should see some new half-formed organs. You know, imagine if someone had an oil filter or air filter or something built in, you know, so they could handle the pollution in China or something, you know, we should see these things. Genetic information is going down. It turns out that every generation we pass on, as far as they've been able to detect thus far, it's been a new science, we pass on 100 genetic defects to our children. And they pass on another 100 genetic defects on top of that to their children. So it turns out that the human DNA, quite honestly, is turning to custard. And we could not have been around for billions of years or hundreds of millions of years because we would have been extinct by now ourselves. It gives me confidence that Jesus might return quite soon. So yes, the information shows that human DNA is deteriorating quite rapidly. Yes.
I believe you haven't answered the lady's question adequately, because if you do a regression of the ages of the first patriarchs, you'll find a different slope altogether from after the flood.
Okay, you are correct. Yes, let me finish answering your question. If I had that chart up there of their ages, they started at 930, and then after the flood, if I had to draw a graph of their ages, Adam and all these guys lived to be about 930. When you plot it, and I also have that chart on my laptop, the ages go slowly down after the flood until King David, I think, was around about 70 years at that point. So we see a greater decline. We don't know what caused that decline. Some have a theory that there was a canopy of water that protected us from ultraviolet or from cosmic radiation, and that collapsed to cause the flood. Most creation scientists are a little bit hesitant to go that way. God did something to reduce their lifespan, and we don't know what it is. Just like we don't know what happened to women, that pain should now come at childbirth, what did God change in the woman? What did God change in the soil of the plants, that they should have thorns or we should have weeds? What did God change when the animals and Noah and his family came off the ark and God said, you can now eat meat, but I'm going to put the fear of man onto the animals? What did he change in the animals as they came off the ark in Genesis 9? Many, many things we don't have any idea, to be honest.
According to Dr. Google...
Yes, my friend Google, I ask him everything.
Apologetics Chris, we caught the carbon dates of two dinosaur bones.
Okay, thank you.
And found the ages between 10 and 14,000 maximum.
Okay, so two dinosaur bones apparently were carbon dated, found to be 10 to 14,000 years maximum, and then again I said that if we correct it for the flood, that would bring it back as well, and it would sort of bring it in the right... 65 million years, is a whole different ballgame.
We'll take two or three more questions, but could I have a couple of Dovedale folk just go and check that the jugs are on for our refreshments? That would be really good. Excellent. So we'll do two or three more questions, and then we'll finish with a song.
Okay, so the man near the back.
It may be worth pointing out, I didn't know about carbon dating, but dinosaur bones have been found by evolutionists that still have soft tissue in them.
Correct. Thank you. That's a good thing to point out. That petrified wood you cannot cut with your carpenter saw. You need a diamond saw to cut this because it's now become basically a piece of rock. bones, if you get a dinosaur bone that is fossilised or mineralised, it's basically the structure of, perhaps it was covered by volcanic ash or covered by mud in a big worldwide flood or something, and the chemicals from the mud seeped into the bone and the bone became rock, and you need a dinosaur to cut fossilised dinosaur bones. However, sometimes when they cut dinosaur bones, it smells like a butcher's shop. Well, we don't have so many butcher's shop anymore, but that smell of burning bone, and it's just like fresh bone. And then they had a T-Rex femur, that's the top leg bone here, and they had a T-Rex femur, I think it was in Montana, in the top of the USA, and they had to carry it in a helicopter, and it was too big or too heavy, they had to break it in half. Anyway, one lady took some fragments of bone and did what nobody else had done before. Dr. Mary Schweitzer put them under the microscope, and it's recorded in the journals what she said. Her colleagues wrote it. She said, "My God, my God." She said, "This is 65 million years old, and it's got remnants of red blood cells in it." She could have said, "My goodness, why do they say that these are 65 million years old when they have red blood cells in them?" And you know, she is working in her lab right now trying to discover how red blood cells can be preserved in the rocks for 65 million years. That's what they are investigating at the moment. So yes, they have found remnants of red blood cells, they found dinosaur bone that is still bone, they have found soft tissue when they dissolved away the bone and found soft tissue. And just last year, they've discovered fresh dinosaur skin. Not the pattern of skin that was sort of impressed in the rock, not just a fossil imprint, but actual dinosaur skin, which they're analysing now, and we might for the first time ever know what colour one particular dinosaur actually was, because we found skin. Imagine your piece of skin, a flake of skin lasting 65 million years old, and just atoms don't hang together that long. Just the physics of it, let alone the chemistry of it. So yes, thank you. Probably the last one.
Just with regard to the field of bringing together statistics and biology, I've done a little bit of reading in that, and I think there's quite a bit of consternation among that particular field when looking at mutation and trying to make sense of evolution that way. I've heard there's a lot of problems in trying to bring the mechanisms of evolution by science and reconciling it with mathematics. I don't know whether you've done study on that.
Dr. Lee Spetner wrote a really good book, I forget the name of it now, a few years ago, on a lot of the statistics and probabilities of things occurring. I'm not sure if that's what you're referring to. Yes, I mean, most mutations, when I say, just to make it clear too, when I say you pass on 100 genetic defects to your next generation, they are 100 changes to your DNA, but they don't necessarily mean that they have defects as in their ears are missing or something is wrong, because most mutations don't produce any outside result. However, as they accumulate over several generations, then that 100 added to the next 100 added to the next 100, then maybe we will be losing IQs. One of the things you should know is that we do not no longer marry our close relatives for this reason, because I might have, my DNA might be damaged, might have the bit for making ears, may be missing from my DNA. But fortunately, my wife is from quite a distant family, even though she was a relative before I married her, because we're all relatives. But my wife might have the bit about noses missing from her DNA, but I've got that bit, and she might have the bit that's missing from mine, so our children actually look okay. Darwin, in fact, married his first cousin. And of their 10 children, only 3 of Darwin's children went on to have children of their own. Darwin, his daughter Annie, died when she was 10. They had a lot of sickness in the family, married the first cousin. Darwin, after his daughter Annie died when she was 10, he was angry at God. "Why could you take away my beautiful daughter?" And he was studying to be a theologian. He was studying theology. And after Annie died, he would take his wife Emma on the arm, and they would walk to church on Sunday morning. They'd get to the steps of the church. They'd go up the steps, and he would release Emma to go to church, and he turned around and went back home. He couldn't understand why God could take away his beautiful little daughter. And so, yeah, it was a bit of a misunderstanding of the world of sin. We don't live in the created world God made. So if you remember that chart up there that had Abraham after 2,000 years, if we went a little bit to the right of the edge of the chart there, Moses would have been there at 2,500 years, just a little bit after Abraham. And Moses was given the law that you should no longer marry a close relative. Abraham married his half-sister Sarai, but in Moses' time he weren't to marry a close relative. Now, if we are 6,000 years from Adam, 2,500 years is about the first, almost the first half of human history. It's pretty close to, I think it's 42%. The first 42% before Moses was given the law, you could marry your close relative. In fact, you had to. But from in the last 58% of time, then we no longer do that because of our genetic declines over these centuries. Does that make sense? For 2,500 years, there was no law against forbidding you to marry your close relative. Okay, we'll finish there. So I'll hand back to Andre for it. Just get your question answered. I'm happy to talk with my
number 525. The incredible thing is about a lot of what we've heard this evening is that God has seen fit to give us an explanation of the origins of this universe in very plain language to set it down in the Bible. That's incredibly comforting, and it's connected, of course, to his provision of a saviour. The Lord Jesus Christ, who came to die on the cross for the forgiveness of sins. And that's another promise, another revelation of God. What must I do to be saved? Believe in the Lord Jesus Christ, and you shall be saved. It's written in black and white. We're going to sing a couple of verses from Jude. Now unto him who is able to keep you from falling, the same God who holds this creation in the palm of his hand, and holds our eternal well-being in the palm of his hand, he's the one who's able to present us faultless before the presence of his glory. So that's what we're going to stand up and sing as we finish this evening. Thank you all again for coming along. Enjoy the party.
Oh, starting to. Good on you.